Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news from Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day, 1939. The president of the U.S., Franklin Roosevelt, would declare neutrality as the U.S.'s position regarding World War II in Europe as it kicked off. At the same time, Barry Hertzog, who was the South African Prime Minister at the time in South Africa, would resign following a failure to get a vote through Parliament in South Africa on the same position. In 1946, on this day, a gentleman by the name of Farouk Bulsara would be born in Zanzibar in Tanzania. If you don't know who that is, he's the front man of Queen, Freddie Mercury. In 1960, Cassius Clay would win gold at the Rome Games in the light heavyweight division. Anyone that needs a translation on that name clearly hasn't watched boxing. In 1975, Gerald Ford, US president, would survive the first assassination attempt on his life. In 1976, a year later, The Muppet Show would be premiering on television. In 1984, P.W. Botha would be the first executive president of South Africa. And in 1991, Nelson Mandela would be chosen as the president of the African National Congress on this day. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we are chatting to the CFOs of three companies, Airports Company South Africa, Harmony Gold, and Sanlam. All three companies gave us results today. Sanlam was interim results. Harmony and Airports Company of South Africa were full year results. We're going to look into all three companies, trying make a sense of all three performances and see where we get to from there. Then we've got a conversation with the group economist at the Standard Bank Group based out of Beijing, Jeremy Stevens, to discuss the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit that's currently taking place. It started on the 3rd of September, expected to run until the 8th of September, and we're going to get a direct conversation from Beijing around what's happening there, what the topics of discussion are about, and what the $50 billion commitment from President Xi Jinping means. Then, because it's Thursday, we've also got an SME. We're going to be chatting to Lelia Hasty, who is the founder of Lelia Hasty Jewelry. We're going to get a sense of her business and what she does.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Let's get right into it with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been an interesting day of movements. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, Viv Govender, to take a look at this and try and understand it. Viv, lovely to speak to you again. Markets kind of having a bit of a mixed bag if you look across European and Asian markets. South Africa also, different sectors having different responses. What do you make of today's movements?
I think the market's a bit nervous ahead of some important jobs numbers from the US tomorrow. I think we saw disappointing jobs numbers today, by the way. And I think the problem is that, you know, at the moment, because people have priced in the interest rate cut so strongly, that any bad news is literally bad news. There is not that silver lining of a bad news means more rate cut chances. Right now, more bad news is just bad news. I think that's kind of like scaring the market a little bit. And that's why we've seen some like big companies, like for instance, NVIDIA pull back. I think partially because of that and partially because of other issues, but I think partially because of the fact that we are thinking that the economy might be weaker than we feared.
Viv, when we look at those numbers, you did mention obviously that those jobs numbers, NFP numbers are coming out tomorrow, but we do always get ADP numbers ahead of that. What is the expectation around NFP tomorrow? Are we kind of looking better than where we are based on what ADP suggests? Or is it just one of those things where the data points just become more and more important for the US as we get closer to those rate cuts dates?
I think right now, it really doesn't matter for the rate cut. I think barring an absolutely spectacularly positive number, the rate cut is pretty much baked in. Mm. We don't have to worry about that. The fear might be a really bad number, which basically is just a bad number. And because the rate cut is baked in, doesn't really give us more rate cuts, you know what I mean? Or significantly more rate cuts, and at least not enough more rate cuts to move the market. And I think that is the fear at the moment. The job number, I think, also has to be taken with a pinch of salt, because we saw recently that the Labor Department in the US came out and basically cut 118,000 jobs from the estimate for the last year. That's about 60,000 plus jobs a year, almost 70,000 jobs per month, cut down. That's a significant, you know, number we're talking about. I think there's always been a fear that the Reserve Bank of the US, the US Fed, is going to get the timing wrong for rate cuts. I think right now, if you had to ask most comments out there, I think the consensus was they waited too long to cut rates.
Mm, mm. And waiting too long could, I mean, if we look at the implications that could have, that we could potentially tip, or the US could tip into a recessionary environment, which is the one thing we don't want, because the narrative that we've had up to this point is everything is going to be a soft landing, right?
Yeah, and the problem with moving too late here is that there's what's called monetary policy lag. So basically, when you do something in monetary policy like cut interest rates, you're not going to get the full effect for maybe a year to two later. So interest rate cuts like this month are going to affect the economy really next year. So if we are going into a recession right now, we are likely not to be able to get out of it just because rates are being cut right now.
Viv, would that lag effect be mitigated, or could it be mitigated by very aggressive cuts, or would that send markets into a separate kind of tailspin to say the US Fed is kind of scrambling here because they got it wrong, and that would be more detrimental if they, say, take a more aggressive stance than what they've done up to this point?
I think the chance of a more aggressive rate cut, I think, than a 0.25% each time is very likely. With the market's pricing, I think, a third chance of a 0.5% cut. If they were to go beyond that, I think the market would be spooked. I think also you have to take into account, I mean, you're supposed to be independent, but the political kind of, impression that you'd get would be quite negative as well, because remember the election in the US is happening in about 2 months' time, on the 5th of November. If the US Fed starts cutting rates significantly just ahead of the US election, the Republicans will probably argue, oh, this is them trying to juice the market to try and, you know, help Kamala Harris get elected next in November. That kind of thing implication comes in about, and I think that's also going to be negative for the Fed, because you really don't want to be seen as taking a side in any kind of political discussion.
I'm so glad we don't have to find ourselves in this precarious position from our perspective. I'm glad we got our elections out of the way. Speaking of local markets, Viv, when we look at the Rand's performance, kind of tapped 18 Rand, managed to come down from that level. Are we kind of optimistic at this point around the South African picture, understanding that obviously we have our own rate cut decision happening later in the month as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we're going to follow the US Fed. They go big, we likely will go big. If they go small, we might go small as well, but they will move before we move. You know, they're the day before us. If they're surprised by not cutting, which would be like a very, very tiny chance of that happening, I don't think we'll have the same ease of cutting as well. I do think that the Rand could get stronger from here. If we saw the GDP number, we did a bit better than we had in some previous periods. And the reason being is that things like load shedding, which are totally self-owned, on-goal kind of situations, were removed. If we can have load shedding, you know, disappear, growth rates in South Africa will be higher, the Rand will be stronger, and we will look a lot better, you know, the next couple of years. Obviously, it's hard to, like, you know, call it, but I mean, we've had, what I think, like 160, 170 days now without load shedding. If that can continue, like I said, indefinitely into the future, I can see the Rand significantly stronger from here. But should we see a turnaround in that? Should we see a turnaround in the GNU, some other global issue happening? You know, who knows? But right now, I think all things as they are right now, the Rand should be trending stronger.
Let's not jinx it. Let's not mention the L word, because apparently that is what the problem is for South Africa. But before I let you go, those GDP expectations, not as high as we thought. I mean, when we looked at some global stats and some global information from institutions like the World Bank, they forecasted quite a stronger turnaround and growth from South Africa's perspective without load shedding. But we take the positive nonetheless. Let's take the positive as it comes.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's positive. I mean, here's the thing. I think for the last 5 years or so, we've been growing at a slower rate than our population was growing. So on average, the average South African was getting poorer year on year. 0.4 is not great, but at least it's at matching kind of our population growth rate. So we kind of stopped the fall, which is a big thing. But also, I think to a certain extent, is stability matters. Give us 3-4 years with no load shedding and let's see the economy recover, because people are still, like, even I am still nervous about the idea that this is going to be the default situation going forward based on just, like I said, you know, a few months of positivity.
Well, let's hope the positivity continues, and let's hope things do stabilize internationally so that everybody gets a better windfall. But we'll leave it at that, Viv. Thanks as always for the time and for the great insights of Viv Govender, Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, on the market movements throughout the day, as well as some expectations that might be lingering in the market.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Harmony Gold provided us with their full year results today as well for the year ended 30 June 2024. I'm joined on the line by Harmony's financial director, Boipelo Lekubo, to take a look at the numbers and make sense of the performance. Good evening, Boipelo. Thanks so much for taking the time. Strong performance from the group, strong gold prices obviously benefiting the business. How do you reflect on the period?
Thank you for having me. Yes, no, absolutely. We've delivered quite an exceptional performance and really combined performance across all our operations. And on the back of strong operational metrics, which included our grade, cost management, as well as the increase in production. So that has all resulted in an expansion in our operating free cash flow margins and improved productivity. So really our ongoing investment in our quality ounces is delivering the desired results that we are seeking in improving our, you know, and improved cash certainty.
Bwibola, obviously, as you mentioned, that cash flow increasing by more than 100% up around to 12 billion rand, but also the headline earnings per share increasing by quite a significant margin there as well. How much of the tailwinds were as a result of that stronger gold price, and how much of it was just as a result of a more efficient operational year from you and the team?
Yeah, so I think maybe if we look at it from a new perspective, that recorded a 25% increase year on year, and really as a result of the higher recovered grades, as I mentioned, so and the 16% increase in the average gold price received. So I'd say yes, you know, the higher gold price did help, but on the back of also our operational efficiency, and more significantly at our higher grade assets being Mponeng and Moab Khatsong, as well as the strong delivery from our Hidden Valley operations.
Bwibola, the business has also been seeing some interesting results from the copper business that you have going on. How are you feeling about that at the moment? I mean, copper prices are certainly softer than where they were this time last year, but nonetheless, copper space is still quite an interesting market. Is it something that the Harmony team is looking at and saying perhaps in future we might even go a little deeper into that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what we have is the Eva Copper Project. So we are currently busy updating that feasibility study. So that is well underway. So since the acquisition, we have about 82,000 meters that we've drilled to grow the project's resource base. And we've significantly de-risked this project to enhance the confidence in our resource estimates. So we should probably have an FID decision, that's a final investment decision, by June of next year, after which then we'll come to the market just to share the results of that feasibility study. But I mean, currently what we've got declared in our mineral resources for Eva Copper is around 366 million tons. That's of copper. We're quite really excited. Obviously, the copper story has gained momentum over time. That speaks well for us.
Bwibola, the all-in sustaining costs for the operations for the year was on a little on the higher side when we look at the rand value of that, but obviously that would have been affected by the exchange rate. Is the sustained cost of around $1,500 per ounce a comfortable kind of area to play in, understanding that the gold price, while it is high at the moment, it could still come back down in months to come? Is where the all-in sustained costs sitting at the moment just a fairly comfortable spot from a margin perspective?
Yeah, so I mean, our costs are quite well contained and predictable and actively managed, that is. So in US dollar terms, that all-in sustaining costs did decrease by 4% to the $1,500 an ounce that you mentioned. And that was really mainly as a result of the higher recovered grades, alongside that 5% depreciation in the average exchange rate. So we do as well have the higher byproduct credits from silver and uranium. So that provides a further offset to those costs per unit. But all in all, I mean, we have guided. What we do is guide in rand per kilogram terms, so not necessarily in dollar terms, just simply due to the fact that obviously, you know, the rand would either appreciate or depreciate, whichever way it does.
Speaking of guidance, the guidance for production going into the new year, is that influenced by anything that's happening at the moment? I mean, the market has kind of definitely stabilized and come around from where it was, say, perhaps one or two financial years ago. And that's obviously a good thing for your mining operations. From a guidance perspective going forward, is this kind of something that you're saying, we're going to stick around this 1.4 million to 1.5 million ounces. We're kind of happy here. We're not going to look to do anything too crazy at this point.
Yes, so I mean, as you saw, our year-on-year production guidance is between the 1.4 to 1.5, and then more particularly on the all-in sustaining cost, we're saying between 1,020,000 rand a kilogram and 1,100,000 rand a kilogram. So we are quite conservative in our planning assumptions, and it should be noted that much of that performance for this year was really an overachievement on our Hidden Valley operation, as well as Mine Waste Solutions and Mponeng, and that was particularly on the back of the higher grades. So our guidance at other operations has remained largely unchanged, but we do expect from Doornkop that mine plan will be revised. So all in all, I think we're quite confident in what we've guided.
Well, Bella, before I let you go, I want to take a look at just how the market has reacted to the news that was delivered today. The share price coming off some 6% at some stage, and the highest of dividends that you have previously put out, but still a strong dividend nonetheless. Do you think the market reacted a bit harshly around just the numbers, given that the performance was such a strong performance?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they reacted harshly. Perhaps maybe, as the market opened, there was a bit of profit taking. With regards to the dividend, I mean, our dividend is consistent. It's fairly well understood. So we return 20% of free cash to the market. The market is well aware that we're in quite a high CapEx phase, going forward. And with Eva Copper as well coming on stream, as I mentioned, FID next year, June. That does also present, quite significant capital, just on that project build. So from a balance sheet perspective, it's important that we retain that flexibility. We are sitting, yes, in a comfortable position from a net cash perspective. However, I think it was prudent for us to keep the dividend as it was until we can at least provide the market with certainty as to what that capital looks like for Eva, as well as what the funding thereof looks like.
It's just smart capital deployment. That's all it comes down to. Thank you so much, Boipelo, for the insights and for the time. Boipelo Lekubo, Financial Director at Harmony Gold, on the strong year that they had and where they are strategically focusing the business to keep on doing well.
What happens when you cross the finish line? As you reach retirement, your life will change. Your investments should too. Wherever you are in life, we have an investment solution for you. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP. You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're taking a look at Sanlam interim results now. They gave us their 6 months results for the 6 months ended June 2024. I'm joined on the line by Sanlam's Chief Financial Officer, Abigail Mukuba, to take a look at this. Abigail, lovely to speak to you again. Strong start to the new financial year. How is the company feeling at the moment?
We're thrilled and excited. Good evening. We're very happy with the performance that we've delivered this 6 months. I think we're more thrilled with the fact that it's quite aligned and consistent with our strategy that we've been moving on since the last 4 years. And we're very happy that the delivery is broad-based across all lines of business within the group. So yeah, we're in high spirits right now.
Abigail, let's look at some of the movements that have come out recently. I mean, the Assupol Sanlam merger, but also the announcement that Sanlam Life is taking a bigger stake in, or readjusting, so to speak, the stake in African Rainbow Capital. You guys are clearly very, very busy.
Yes, we're busy, but hopefully we're busy with the right things in the sense that all the M&A activity that we have announced that we're busy with are aligned in totally with our strategy, and are aligned with our vision, what we call Vision 2030. So we're very happy with the consistency and the fact that we are strict to sticking to our strategy in delivery. And again, this is just another piece to make sure that we deliver on that vision.
Abigail, the company saw some really strong numbers from a headline earnings perspective. All the metrics are looking good from that perspective. Despite this, the business elected to not declare an interim dividend at the stage, rather, and Obviously, with some of the M&A activity, like boosting the stake in Afrocentric, take me through the thought process and the strategy from a business perspective to say, we'd rather just have certain things in a row first, and a dividend can always come at a later date.
Maybe just to confirm or correct you there. So it's not that we have decided not to declare a dividend. We are not a two times a year dividend payer. We're actually an annual dividend payer, and this is our half year results. If I look at the performance that we've delivered now, you talked about the earnings growth as an example. If you look at our cash earnings growth as well, it's consistent with our underlying earnings growth. So if I just look at our projections and how we've performed now, we're well on our way to maintaining our dividend paying capacity and capability at the end of the year. The only reason we're an annual payer and not a two times payer, the cost of actually and the process of paying out dividends, if you know that we used to be a mutual, and our shareholders are primarily, or is still a large base of our shareholders is still our policyholders. So the cost of actually paying dividend twice a year actually distracts value rather than saving the value and paying dividends once a year. So it's not that we are redirecting capital from paying dividends to doing M&A activity. At this stage, all our M&A activity has not come at the expense of dividend. We continue to pay dividends. We're just an annual payer.
That's it. It's just the policy that is in place from the company's perspective. Abigail, before I let you go, I want to look forward to the next 6 months. How are we feeling about the next 6 months? How are we feeling about things like rate cuts and the state of the South African economy and the South African consumer? Are we optimistic around a strong second half or a stronger second half?
We are optimistic about a strong second half. I think we will all be naive to ignore that our people and our economy is still under a lot of pressure. There's a lot of optimism and a lot of efforts that's going into turning things around. And already, I think we're already in the third quarter of the year. So we're seeing that the second half should deliver quite a strong result that is also probably consistent or at similar levels to the first half. But I think overall, if you look at things like policies and lapses and persistency trends in the second half of the year, we expect that should continue to hold in terms of reduced cancellations and lapses. And we will continue to focus on improving persistency, particularly in the entry-level market. But in the affluent segment, we're maintaining the stable persistency, and we expect that business to continue to deliver.
Mm. I know we're reflecting on the first half that was, and the implementation of the two-pot kind of really wouldn't be in any of these numbers. But from a general sentiment and from a general sense within the business, are you seeing an uptick in activity or an uptick in interest, at least now that the implementation date has come?
We've definitely experienced, obviously, it's literally a few days since it was effective, we've definitely experienced in these past few days a large number of clients that have started to inquire about their two-pot retirement fund withdrawals. We've been accommodating the client inquiries, but we have noticed, whether it's on the phone, at the call centers, or online, that we've got a spike in terms of activity. And I think we expected it. It's not that it's something that we had not planned for. So our platforms are dealing with the increased volumes, but it's still early days in terms of understanding exactly the exact numbers of people that are applying for withdrawals.
It certainly is still early days, and we'll probably catch up with these developments around the end of the year. But for now, Abigail, thanks so much for that update. We wish you the best of luck in the second half of the year, and we will catch up soon. That's Abigail Mukuba, who's Chief Financial Officer at Sanlam, on their first 6 months of the year's performance.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's just gone 6:29. If you're tuning in, you're listening to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and we're chatting to the Airports Company of South Africa. They gave us their full year's numbers for the financial year ended 30 June 2024 as well. And I'm joined, 31 March 2024. And I'm joined on the line by the Chief Financial Officer at the Airports Company of South Africa, Luzuko Mbotia, to take a look at these numbers. Luzuko, thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with your initial reflections and thoughts on the numbers. Certainly a better set of numbers than last year's.
Thank you, Jimmy, and good evening to the listeners at home. Yeah, it is certainly a good story to tell for us. Just comparing to last year numbers, we've really performed well. This is really at the back of strong traffic that we've experienced across our 9 airports, and we're quite pleased with the results, both on the aeronautical and aeronautical revenue.
Luzuko, we'll get into some of the specifics in a second. I want to just start with, obviously, the headline figure, looking at the fact that it's almost a 1 billion rand swing from a 400 million rand loss to a 400 million rand profit. That could not have been easy to achieve without some hard work being put in. What changed in the year? What was done differently?
Look, it's really a number of factors, right? So if you just look at our business key drivers, traffic really in the center of it. As mentioned earlier, that has huge impact on our revenue top line, both aeronautical and non-aeronautical. And what we did as well was to deploy a lot of cost containment initiatives. These were done 2019, post-2019 years, and they have started to bear fruit, and we've benefited in the current year from those savings. Yes, whilst payroll has increased, employee costs rather have increased in the current year, the OPEX, we've managed to contain it quite moderately. And we've earned some income as well, some investment income and paid finance costs. So really a cocktail of factors that have contributed to the bottom line.
Mm. Luzuko, you bring up those employee expenses, and I mean a 27% increase in employee expenditure would ordinarily be quite concerning for any company, but when I had a look at some of the details around the fact that this is off the back of a staff reduction program, you now have better incentives and benefits going back to employees, including incentive bonuses, it's a 27% increase. That's a good thing this time around.
Look, I think context is important, right? Mm. To your point that you're making, yeah. We, a few years ago, just post-COVID, we introduced a VSP where we lost almost 1,000 employees. And this was really at the back of low traffic, no activities at all in our traffic in our airports. Post-COVID, where we are seeing increasing traffic. As a result, we need to capacitate. And that's precisely what we're doing. And that's what is reflected on the 27% is us really going back and increasing our headcount so that we really have a fit for purpose and optimal structure that can respond to the increased traffic. So it really is nothing out of the ordinary. Most companies do that. When you increase activities, you have to deploy the necessary resources and capacity. But we do expect the employee costs to really temper down in the next couple of years once we have the right capacity. And then we'll just continue growing it at a normal CPI, inflationary increase year on year.
Mm. Luzuko, I want to take a look at some of the things that might have concerned investors in these latest sets of numbers. There were a lot of restatements to previous financial statements. It seems as though there were a lot of errors in the past that have now had to be corrected or misstatements that have had to be corrected. That's the one side of it. And the other one is obviously the biometrics conversations that have happened recently with the biometrics contracts. Let's start with the restatements. What was happening there where we now have to go back and relook at those financials?
Look, the key big one would be the rehabilitation provision. And this is really at the back of a new legislation by NERSA pertaining to our jet fuel infrastructure. So in the previous year, there was a legislation that was passed to then request all owners of such structure to make provisions. And due to the newness of the legislation, we really could not quantify then the provision. In the recent months, we've been able then to do the quantification, and hence we've put through the number and also in the prior year. The other misstatements, or rather adjustments, are really not that material, pertaining to assets that were previously recorded at 1 rand, and now we needed to revalue those assets, rather restate the value of those assets, and again, not really a major impact in our financials. On the last issue, on the I think was it IT?
It was the biometrics, the biometrics tenders, and the challenges that were experienced with regards to that. How has that impacted the business, and how has that impacted travelers' experiences? Understanding that that contract has now been cancelled.
Not as yet. I mean, this is a project that is in progress. We had not fully implemented. But we were in progress and in implementing it. But we will certainly find alternative means to continue the project.
Luzuko, the positives that we did see within the numbers as well were around the fact that the gearing of the business has improved. And as we close off our conversation, I want to reflect on that and look to what this means for the business going forward. We've seen a lot of state-owned entities having a heavy reliance on things like bailouts from the government's perspective. You clearly seem to be getting back to standing on your own two feet and not needing that. Are we seeing that the better decisions and the better outcomes that you're going through now mean that the business is going to have less reliance on the government support?
Yes, certainly. I mean, we've really never relied on government per se. I mean, in the past, we've the only support that we received, I think, just in the last 5 years, was a preference share, which was not a bailout.
Mm.
You know, it's a financial instrument that is issued to any entity. The gearing, really, the reduction in gearing, really is a function of exceptional cash-generating activities. This is at the back of cash optimization initiatives that we've deployed. And to your point earlier, we have a good gearing, and our results also reflect that. And most importantly, we are declaring dividends, which we seldomly find in the SOE space. And we're quite excited and quite looking forward to declare and to inject funds back to the fiscus.
I think this is the first time or the second SOE to declare dividend in the last couple of years back to the government. So certainly a positive direction for the Airports Company of South Africa. We wish you the best of luck in the new financial year and all the hard work that you guys are going to continue putting into the business. But we'll leave the conversation there for now. Thanks so much, Luzuko, for those insights. Luzuko Mbotja, Chief Financial Officer at the Airports Company of South Africa, on a strong recovery for the business and a strong positioning going forward.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit is currently taking place in Beijing. The event started early this week and will run through until the 8th of September. There are various countries from the African continent in Beijing at the moment to try and get investment commitments out of the Chinese business community. And just today at the event, the president of China, President Xi Jinping, announced that there would be a $50 billion commitment from China to African countries over the next 3 years. I'm joined on the line by Jeremy Stevens, economist at the Standard Bank Group, to take a look at this and other developments taking place at the summit. Good evening, Jeremy. Thanks so much for taking the time. A $50 billion commitment is certainly a significant commitment. What do you make of just everything that's been happening? Give us a sense of what the mood is like at the summit and all of the happenings that are going on at the moment.
Well, it's been very, very, very busy. I can tell you that. We've been working with our contacts at ICBC and hosting significant parallel meetings with all of our key clients. Yesterday we had Cyril Ramaphosa and about 100 South African businesses having a SAS China summit. And then, like you've said already, today is the sort of big meeting between the presidents. That's today, and then tomorrow is going to be a business summit. So very, very busy agenda, action-packed. Leadership from all over Africa is here. All the streets are being blocked off. You can barely get anywhere without sort of bumper-to-bumper traffic. So it's pretty crazy. African flags flying all over Beijing at the moment, and thousands of businessmen have congregated to the east side of Beijing, where we're having significant parallel discussions as well. So a lot going on, a lot to digest, and we as a bank are obviously keenly engaged in what's going on in this, probably Africa's most consequential commercial partnership, but it's obviously also undertaking its own, China's going through its own internal adjustment, which is obviously affecting the way that it connects to the rest of the world. So navigating that new era is certainly something that we're watching very closely.
Jeremy, what is on the agenda for the summit this year? I mean, we've got a sense of the commitments that have been made. We've got an idea of what's happening. But what are the talking points that are on the agenda? African countries, I imagine, are bringing forward needs or assistance that they are looking for. And China's expressed an interest in renewable energies. What is on the agenda?
So there's a lot, right? China's trying to sort of push a more mature engagement with the African side. And the African side are also trying to basically push for industrialization, push for China's support in terms of modernization, keep infrastructure on the agenda, help with partnerships from China, sort of help sort of get more market access for China, for African exports to China. We're seeing a big sort of push from the African side to try and attract inward investment from Chinese corporates to help modernize and industrialize. There's a lot of conversations around how Chinese companies can sort of set capacity in Africa to then sell into the intra-Africa free trade zone. There's conversations around agro-processing. It really does cover the whole ambit of commercial ties, and it reflects a maturing of relationships. So since sort of basically 2015, China's been moving away from checkbook diplomacy and big sort of concessional lending into Africa for our infrastructure. And more the pledges are sort of aligning to supporting trade and trying to encourage and incentivize Chinese private businesses to set up capacity in Africa.
Jeremy, one of the big things that's been a talking point within the Chinese picture has always been, or has recently been, that the Chinese economy might not be doing so well, the Chinese consumers might not be doing so well, global expectations have kind of softened around Chinese output, and so it's dampened kind of global outlooks in general. What is the actual mood on the ground in Beijing? Is it the same? Are Chinese businesses and Chinese private investors feeling the same way, or are they ready to commit?
I've been basically telling the same story for the past decade to our clients offshore, which is essentially the Chinese economy is going to continue to slow down. In 2013, Xi Jinping basically made the case that the economy is no longer going to grow as fast as it was, and they're pivoting away from investment-led growth, easy credit, and trying to sort of encourage a consumption-oriented economy. In 2015, there was a big sort of boom bust in the stock market. The economy was going through sort of years of deflation. They burned through about $1 trillion of FX reserves because of a currency devalue. And then they got serious and de-risked in the financial sector and sort of clamping down on the what they called the disorderly expansion of capital. 2017, then Xi Jinping was signaling, look, we're calling it the new era. And that was when it sort of creeped into the conversation with housing of living in, not for speculation. And now in 2023, we see this new productive forces, which is really essentially them trying to move up the value chain, support advanced manufacturing, upgrade traditional manufacturing, and push very hard in the renewable energy space. So the Chinese economy is going through a substantial adjustment, which is fundamentally affecting the way that it connects to the rest of the world. And we all need to come to terms with this reality. Now, if you ask me on the ground, it's important because obviously all of your listeners are going to be thinking about what's happening to the Chinese consumer. And the truth is, a lot of the interventions that we're seeing to support consumption, whether it's subsidizing certain purchases of EVs or whatever it may be, the reality is that all it's basically doing is cannibalizing consumption from elsewhere, because fundamentally the fact of the matter is sentiment is very, very low. It's collapsed and it's remained low. Income growth in China is barely keeping pace with nominal GDP growth. Fewer sectors are actually creating jobs. Property prices, where the vast majority of people's wealth sits, have been falling for the past 3 years. And so households are on less confidence about their future and opting to save a greater proportion of their income. And this has been a steadfast trend since 2021. And it's weaker than we thought it was going to be, but we knew it was going to be weak. And policymakers, as I've said, this is not a part of the economy that they've traditionally been very effective at stimulating. They're much more accustomed to supporting investment-led growth. It's part of the reason why they've pushed so aggressively in the renewable energy space, because that is something that is more in their wheelhouse. But the truth of the matter is the Chinese economy is struggling, and I'm not that confident that anytime soon there's going to be a sort of change in what we're seeing, which is momentum loss, because a lot of the tools and mechanisms that they are putting in place to support the economy from the new productive forces side are going to take multiple years before they start to filter through to people's expectations and real life experience and encourage them to sort of change their expectations. So, for example, if you're a university graduate and you've just graduated from university in China, your outlook for your future income prospects have been downgraded dramatically. Tsinghua University did a survey where they asked university graduates a year ago, how much money do you think you'll make in within 4 years? And the average was about a million renminbi per year, which is way, way out of kilter with the reality. The reality is people make about 8,000 renminbi a month. So that adjustment is something that we're going to see affect people's behavior for multiple years. And only when, if China becomes the greenest economy in the world and they hit all their targets years before and they've got the most sort of sophisticated energy infrastructure and engineering jobs and their grids is the most sophisticated in the world, then maybe it will start creating the jobs that are needed to reinstall confidence in the direction of the country. But right now, we're kind of in the middle of this transition phase where a lot of private businesses and a lot of consumers are more concerned than they've ever been before.
Certainly some interesting developments from that perspective. Jeremy, before I let you go, the other topic of discussion that's been tabled for this particular summit is a look at, from an African perspective at least, investing in local currency ecosystems. Have you heard any rumblings or any mentions around the BRICS payment systems and what the Chinese government wants to do around that?
Yeah, so that's a sort of key example, similarly to renewable energy, where you see the sort of forces at play and the geopolitical forces at play in China marry quite neatly with their relationship with Africa. And clearly, China's been pushing for multiple years to sort of expand the use of renminbi. It really did pause after 2015. So basically, they were making incremental progress up until that point, but it was still at relatively low levels, but it was moving in the right direction. And then this devalue of the currency really did sort of stop that process. And only sort of subsequently after COVID and the Ukraine crisis, where you've seen a sort of another push for China to start using its currency more in terms of its international payments and transactions. And Africa is a sort of low-hanging fruit for that because it's obviously an area where there are bidirectional flows of renminbi into and out of Africa. At the same time, there's political goodwill, and a lot of this is being pushed less by market forces and more by policy interventions. But it's been slow going. I think it's about 27% of China's trade is now being transacted in renminbi. And my guess is it's probably lower in Africa than it is elsewhere, because a lot of our exports are simply priced in dollars and our commodities, and it hasn't really got off the ground. And obviously at the FOCAC summit, China's keen to get this back on the agenda. And I expect there to be some kind of announcements over the next 24 hours regarding more usage of the renminbi in transactions and more local currency usage for financing Chinese projects in Africa. But again, in many respects, this isn't being sort of demanded by the market. This is more being pushed by policy. And so as a result, progress has been relatively slow. And the incentives to that end haven't necessarily been that profound, or at least the degree to which you would probably need to trigger the commercial usage of renminbi to expand. So it's really not something that they've made dramatic progress with, but it's clearly something that's very much front of mind for Chinese policymakers. And I would make the case that anywhere where Africa can align to what China's interests are, that's good, because the traditional sort of connection between China and Africa are diminishing over time as China rebalances its economy. And so things like renewable energy and renminbi internationalization are at least aligned to China's interests. But at the same time, I think this relationship needs a sort of a pause where Africa becomes better at preparing itself for these summits and is much more forceful and vocal in tabling exactly what it wants from that relationship, and so that it can benchmark what they believe is China's progress in Africa. And I would make the case that that has a lot to do with African diversification, industrialization, modernization, job creation, skill transfers, and those kinds of areas. And we need to actually be quite open about this is what we care about, this is what we want from China, because I think if you put those on the table, I think China will do everything it can to be a partner that delivers, because geopolitically, Africa's support is so important to the Chinese at this juncture.
Some very interesting reflections on the developments unfolding at the Forum on China-Africa Cooperations taking place in Beijing. I think we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights, Jeremy. That's Jeremy Stevens, economist at the Standard Bank Group, currently in Beijing at the FOCAC summit that's taking place there.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's a Thursday evening, and that means it's another SME that we're going to get into. We're going to be speaking to a business owner who founded a very interesting jewelry business after an even more interesting personal journey. I'm joined on the line by Lilia Hasty, who is the founder of Lilia Hasty Jewelry, to take a look at the company, what she does, and how she got into it. Lilia, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start at the beginning. Let's start with your journey into the jewelry space. How did you become a jeweler?
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me, and good evening. My journey into becoming a jewelry designer was sort of one of being quite a lost young student out of school, but young adult. And it really took me a while to figure out what I wanted to do, where my passion lied. But unfortunately, I'd also not done very well in matric, so I was just quite a disengaged student, not a bad student, but just not a, yeah, an engaged student, I think is the best word. So I kind of cut off those opportunities for myself early on, didn't get a university entrance. So being a 19-year-old off in the world kind of is a huge confidence knock, knowing that, you know, your options are kind of limited. And so I think after about five gap years, if I'm being quite frank, I realized, okay, no, we need to go do something properly. So I went to my folks and I pitched the idea, you know, how about I start from the beginning, I'll rewrite my matric if need be, like, what are my options? Let's start this over. And so psychometric tests and looking at very different options of technicons and, like, you know, trades work as well. They said, all right, well, you've got a 3D mind, and I had a creative streak, and jewelry came up as an option. And jewelry design and manufacture is, it's a actual degree, very technical, in the fine arts department at Tshwane University of Technology. And I had no idea it was a very serious, you know, course. So it's a full on degree that you can go get your master's in and everything. So I ended up applying with an open mind, but also with a gusto of saying, you know what, I got to make this work. Like, I'm 24 now, I've run out of time, but there's a different level of commitment and hunger when you appreciate having lost 5 years. You know, like, when my friends were graduating their degrees, I was only sort of beginning mine. So it was just like a different drive and a different perspective than being fresh out of school. And I excelled. And it was like my friends and family didn't quite even recognize me, because I had just like formed into this straight A student. I was getting like 90s for everything and working incredibly hard. But I had just like completely fallen in love with this craft. And also completely fallen in love with the feeling of achieving and being in an institution and an environment that fed my hunger and, you know, nourished that learning. And so, yes, 10 years ago, I was in first year. And ever since then, it's kind of just blossomed since then.
It's amazing what you can do when you actually find your passion. Lilia, let's look at the jewelry business. You've now become a jeweler. You've gone into this business. What kind of pieces are you making? What's inspiring your pieces? Where does it all come from now?
Okay, so the sector that I'm in the jewelry industry is your fine jewelry. So you were dealing in diamonds, precious metals, your gold, your platinums. So that is the trades of being a goldsmith. And my market, I would say my bread and butter is engagement rings. Your South African customer is mostly going to purchase one big piece in their lifetime, and that's really focused around the engagement ring. Seldom do you have in our market someone looking for very extravagant pieces in gold and diamonds. There are obviously sectors that appeals to, but that's my main market. And then sort of past that, from the creative perspective, I really like to play around with a little bit more avant-garde, contemporary pieces. But the core of the brand and the core of the product is the story behind it, because the only real function of jewelry is sentiment. You know, I mean, life will go on without the use of something around your finger, but there is a need that, in terms of like status, but in marital status or power status, those are kind of the functions that jewelry fulfill. So if we're playing on the heartstrings and it's a term of an object of endearment, when you're giving a token of your love to a loved one, and that could even be an anniversary presents or mother to daughter or, you know, family member gifts, at the end of the day, a story about what they mean to you and what this piece symbolizes, I think, carries so much weight and kind of like seals the deal of the sentiment. So I really like to play with a metaphor or a saying or a message and kind of code it into the symbolism of the piece by using shapes. Or like, you know, if you look at a piece, it might be, oh, that's really nice. But if I tell you the story, for instance, my main collection is called Journey. And it looks very pretty, but the winding curves of it is literally an extract of a photo of when you have a hill and the road winds down the hill. And that symbolizes this universal emblematic thing of like we all go through so much in our lives. And no matter where you are in your life, you're on this journey, and the diamonds within those curves are your milestones. And I've had such amazing conversations with customers in different points in their lives, and there's people have been able to resonate with that. So I think ultimately, but besides the fact that we're dealing in commodities like your precious metals and diamonds, at the core of it is the story, it is the message, it is the sentiment.
Lilia, you've been at this for, as you said, over 10 years now, and or close to 10 years at least. And in that time, you've won quite a few accolades. Take me through the experience and the feeling of winning the De Beers Shining Lights competition.
Yes, sure. So the winning the De Beers Shining Light competition in 2015. So the competition is an amazing initiative that's been running for about 30 years. And it invites jewelry design students or people who have the relevant skills, like apprentices who are versed in jewelry design, to participate. And you design jewelry according to a theme. So you will take the theme and run with it and explore what your perception of what that theme could be. Like, for example, the year that they did, the theme that they did this year was luxury redefined. So challenging the normal perception and understanding of what luxury is, and then reimagining what that could mean now. For example, cars and planes and sort of those types of objects are your normal global symbols of luxury, old school perception. But, you know, now there's a carbon footprint, and now there's a lot more awareness around our environment and how important it is to look after our environment. And so how are we now looking at luxury through that perspective? So that's just basically what the competition challenges you to do is to design with the message. And so in 2015, I was fortunate enough to win the highest accolade of this competition.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave that conversation there. But thank you so much, Lelia, for the time, for the insights, for giving us a bit of a better understanding of your business. We'll definitely put up the details to that business online. That was Lelia Hasty, who is the SME of the week for this week. It's coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, and Michael Abramson is following through with the sports roundup thereafter. From my side, good night.